Welcome to Literary Arts, The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Our speaker this time is writer Chimamanda Adichie. Adichie was 26 years old when her first book, Purple Hibiscus, was published. At age 30, she won the Orange Prize for her second book, Half a Yellow Sun, and by age 31, Adichie was a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant. When Adichie was just 10, she read Chinua Achebe's classic, Things Fall Apart, and said she realized that people like herself could live in books. In a recent TED Talk, Adichie talked about the limitations and dangers of telling just one story about a people or a nation, and the importance of telling many different stories to reveal the truth. About the novel Half a Yellow Sun, Chinua Achebe said of Adichie, "We do not usually associate wisdom with beginners, but here is a new writer endowed with the gift of ancient storytellers." Join us now for Chimamanda Adichie, here in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures 2012.
I'm really happy to be here. It's my first time in Portland. I've wanted to come for a long time, and I've heard very lovely things about Portland. Apparently, it's supposed to be very hip. The weather, but it's lovely to be here, and this is such a beautiful theater. I am particularly excited to be here. I really want to say thank you to that lovely man, Andrew, who is actually the reason I'm here, because he bullied me into coming. But because he's such a lovely man, I didn't mind being bullied by him. And I think his curly hair is so cool. But I'm particularly excited about being here because when I first came to the U.S. and I started college in Philadelphia, it was a very strange thing. But one of the highlights of being in college in Philadelphia was that I met this wonderful woman who became my best friend in college. And her name is Caroline. And she's here today. And I haven't seen her until I saw her this morning. I hadn't seen her in 10 years or something. So we spent a lovely afternoon just catching up. And I want to embarrass her thoroughly and ask her to stand up. Where is she? I miss her! So I would like to, I'd like to do this talk about what I like to call a cultural history of my writing, which is also the story of the house in which I grew up. So I'd like to start by talking about bagels. As a child in Nigeria, I once read an American novel in which a character ate something called a bagel for breakfast. So I had no idea what a bagel was. But I thought it sounded very elegant and very exotic. I pronounced it bagel. So I desperately wanted to have a bagel. So my family visited the US for the first time when I was 9. And at the airport in New York, I told my mother that as a matter of the gravest urgency, we had to buy a bagel. And so my mother went to a cafe and bought one. Finally, I would have a bagel. Now you can imagine my disappointed surprise when I discovered that this bagel, this wonderful, glorious bagel, was really just a dense donut. I should say I've come to like bagels, but I love to tell this story because of how I think it illustrates the idea of books enlarging our imaginations, how wonderful books are at enlarging our imaginations. So even though a bagel ended up not being some sort of exquisite confection, the moments in which I thought it was were well worth it because my imagination soared in delight. And there was also something comforting and instructive in that discovery of a bagel, in the demystifying ordinariness of the bagel, the realization that other people like me ate boring food. As a child, books were the center of my world. Stories entranced me, reading them and writing them. I've been writing since I was old enough to spell. My writing, when it is going well, gives me what I like to describe as extravagant joy. It is my life's one true passion. It is, in addition to the people I love, what makes me truly happy. And like all real passions, my writing has enormous power over me. There is the extravagant joy when it is going well. And when it is not going well, when I sit in front of my computer and the words simply refuse to come, I feel a soul-crushing anxiety, and I sink into varying levels of depression. Most times, in response to this, I read. I read the authors I love, the poems of Derek Walcott, the prose of John Gregory Brown, the poems of Tanure Ojaide, the prose of Ama Ata Edu. And I hope that their words will water my mind, as it were, and get my own words growing again. But if that doesn't work, I take to my bed and eat a lot of ice cream. Or I watch YouTube videos about natural black hair. Or I simply spend all of my time online shopping. And I particularly favor websites that offer free returns, because I end up returning most of what I buy. But all of this is done with the hope that my words will come back soon, and also with the always hovering fear at the back of my mind that they will not. But they always do. So far, the words have always come back. I write because I have to. I write because I cannot imagine my life without the ability to write or to imagine or to dream. I write because I love the solitude of writing, because I love the near mystical sense of creating characters who sometimes speak to me. I write because I love the possibility of touching another human being with my work, because I spend a large amount of time in the spaces between the imaginary and the concrete. My writing comes from hope, from melancholy, from rage, from curiosity. Writing is this wondrous, inexplicable gift that I have been blessed with. But it is also a craft, a steely determination to sit down for hours and write and rewrite until my neck muscles tighten and throb with pain. And then I need a massage. I have read of some writers' elaborate rituals, and I have also sometimes been tempted to claim an equally elaborate ritual of my own. I've been tempted, for example, to claim that I light red candles and that I hold incredible yoga positions for hours, or that I recite an Igbo chant and fall into a trance before I actually begin to write. But although my ritual is in truth significantly less colorful than what I would like it to be, it exists, and it involves, among other things, wandering around the house. My husband and I joke about how, when I am at home and all is quiet and all distraction turned off and I am supposed to be writing, I am instead spending most of the time wandering around the house, from the study to the bedroom to the kitchen, and all over again. And my husband will come home from work and say to me, "So how did the wandering go today?" And so this brings to mind a wonderful quote from Don DeLillo, which goes like this: "Writers go out of their way to secure their solitude. And then, having secured it, they go out of their way to squander it." I feel like Don DeLillo is my kindred spirit. But that wandering really is in itself part of the process of trying to get into a creative space. And while I do not light red candles, and there are no particular objects that are central to my creativity, there is a house that is, and that is the house in which I grew up, number 305 Margaret Cartwright Avenue, at the University of Nigeria in Osoka. Some years ago, while I was on book tour, I was asked by an earnest American boy, "Will you always write about Nigeria, or will you write about normal places?" Until then, I had not realized that Nigeria was not normal. I often say that I love Nigeria sometimes I'm defensive in professing this love. Yes, there are problems of corruption and inequality, I say, but there's a wonderful proverb from Mali which says, your mother is your mother, even if one of her legs is broken. Of course, this love I profess must be qualified. There is much I do not love about Nigeria, much I wish I could change, much about which I feel by turns anger and shame and bewilderment and disgust. But love is an emotion that does not depend on perfection. And so to say I love Nigeria is to say that I love some kernels of it. My ancestral hometown, Aba. The University Primary School, a wonderful, wonderful school where I learned almost everything I know today. And most of all, the house in which I grew up, number 305 Margaret Cartwright Avenue. And so now, a little potted history. 100 years ago, West Africa was a diverse, vibrant place. In what is now called Nigeria, there were great kingdoms like the Benin Kingdom, the Oyo Kingdom. There were small republican groups like the Igbo. Then the Europeans decided that Africa was a rather interesting cake that they wanted to share among themselves. And they met in Berlin, and they laid Africa on the table and cut it up like a birthday cake. And one of the slices that went to Britain was in West Africa, and it was a country that they would name after the River Niger, Nigeria. Under British colonialism, Christianity came, and with it, Western education. Nigeria had a university college, which was part of the University of London. But shortly before Nigeria became independent in 1960, the government decided that it wanted to establish the first indigenous university, one that would not be affiliated to the University of London or to any British university. And it chose, for the site of this first university, a town of rolling hills and red dust called Nsukka. A founding committee was set up for the new university, and this committee consisted of Nigerians, British, and Americans. One of the Americans was a woman named Marguerite Cartwright. She was a sociologist and a journalist. Her name was Marguerite, but I'm going to call it Margaret from now because that's what we called it in Nigeria. When the university was finally started, the first streets on the campus would be named after the members of this founding committee. So one of those streets had two-story buildings and large yards and whistling pine hedges, and it was called Margaret Cartwright Avenue. My father was part of the first wave of Nigerian academics who began teaching at Nsukka in 1960. He had a degree in pure and advanced mathematics, but the university already had mathematicians. And so they wanted to start a statistics department, and so my father was hired to teach statistics, even though he really had very little idea what statistics was. And he says that he sometimes just learned as he taught. I wonder how his students are faring now. He lived at first in a flat on Elias Avenue. Mr. Elias was a Nigerian member of the founding committee. Then my father married my mother in 1964. He became a senior lecturer and they moved to a new house on Odim Street into a small bungalow with a tiny veranda and a cluster of flowers by the front door. In 1976, he became a full professor. At this point, I think he had gotten the hang of statistics. And because I'm a hopeless and utter daddy's girl, I would like to just pause to describe my father. He is a quiet, unassuming man. He's a gentle man and a gentleman. He's a committed university teacher. He's a man of immense integrity. And he was also Nigeria's first professor of statistics. I adore him. He turned 80 a few months ago, and he still lives in Nsukka. And so when he became a full professor in 1976, they moved to another house, a large, spacious bungalow on Mbanefo Street. In September of 1977, after I was born at the University Teaching Hospital, I was brought back to this house, wrapped in a soft blanket in my mother's arms. I spent the first 5 years of my life there, but I don't remember it very much. Then, in 1982, my father was appointed deputy vice chancellor of the university, and assigned a new house, number 305, Margaret Cartwright Avenue. It had a gracious graveled driveway, a wide yard, which in front was bright with red hibiscuses and purple bougainvillea. And at the back was dense with avocado, mango, and cashew trees. The first time we saw the house, we looked at the living room, the dining room, the kitchen, and then it was time to go upstairs. I began to cry when I saw the stairs, endless, gleaming a deep burgundy, insurmountably high. I stood there and refused to climb. Finally, my big sister Uche held my hand and we took it one step at a time until we got to the top. But only weeks later, I was whooping and sliding on a pillow down the banister with my brothers to see who would do it the fastest before my mother came home. I remember playing football, I mean what Americans call soccer, with my brothers on the lawn outside. And I remember the gardener, whose name was Jomo, asking us not to trample the baby flowers. I remember the frangipani tree that we climbed and from which I once fell off, and the guava tree to which we tied chickens before they were killed for Sunday lunch. I remember riding bicycles up and down the slope of Margaret Cartwright Avenue. I remember the horribly flat, oversized cockroaches that crawled in with the rainy season and smelled like something rotten. We called them American cockroaches. This is true. They were not the usual small size of Nigerian cockroaches, and I'm not sure whether they were called American cockroaches because they were larger than normal. But I think the story was that they were not indigenous to Nigeria, and that they had been brought by one of the American staff of the university. My brother, Oke, a keen animal lover, had a collection of rabbits, guinea pigs, turtles. He kept them in the boys' quarters in the back, which was also where our house helps lived and where we roasted cashew nuts. A rickety shed made of corrugated iron stood at the entrance to the compound, a booth for the security guards, old men in brown uniforms and matching berets who often slept through hot afternoons. I would come to know one of them well, the gentle, ashy-skinned Vincent, who would ask my brothers and me to sit beside him in the shed and would tell us Igbo folk stories about the cunning tortoise. I shared the biggest room upstairs with my brothers, Oke and Kene. It had three beds, dressers, a wardrobe. It did not have a desk. It led out to a veranda where we played paper people, where I read Enid Blyton, where I skulked and watched the older, handsome boy from next door. The veranda had a second door that led to the study, my father's dusty lair, lined with shelves of statistics journals and dominated by the large desk on which were placed files, books, paper clips, pens, and at the farthest corner, the black rotary phone. I wonder now why the phone was kept in the study instead of the corridor downstairs, but it was. And so throughout secondary school, I had uncomfortable conversations with friends while my father sat there marking his students' papers. Parts of the desk were so dusty, I wrote down phone numbers with my finger. Or I just doodled. I wrote my first book at 10 on that desk in a lined exercise notebook, and it was titled Down Macintosh Lane. Before we moved into number 305 Margaret Cartwright Avenue, Chinua Achebe and his family lived there. I realize now what an interesting coincidence it is that I grew up in a house previously occupied by the writer whose work is most important to me. There must have been literary spirits in the bathroom upstairs. And I say this because I often got story ideas after I had bucket baths in the bathroom upstairs. But the only manifest Achebe legacy was on a window ledge in the dining room, scratch written in the childish hand of his daughter, her name, Wando Achebe. I did not find it particularly remarkable at the time that I had lived in this house. The university campus was a small place. People moved in and out of university housing. The academic community was a small one. Years later, when my first novel was published, and I told my editor, you know, I said to her, it's kind of interesting. I lived in the house previously occupied by Chinua Achebe. And I said it was sort of a passing comment, and she stopped and stared at me, and she said, what? This is the most interesting thing you've told me about yourself. So now two little stories about Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart. I read a lot of British children's literature when I was growing up, and I was particularly enamored of Enid Blyton. I think Enid Blyton in her grave must be turning over and over because I talk about her all the time. I thought that books had to have white people in them by their very nature. So when I started to write, as I was old enough to spell, I wrote the kinds of stories that I was reading. So I had all of these characters who were white and who lived on Macintosh Lane and, you know, who had dogs called Socks, which was an improbable name for a dog in Nigeria. And also, my characters drank a lot of ginger beer. Because Enid Blyton's characters just spent a lot of time drinking ginger beer. Never mind that I had no idea what ginger beer was. And for many years afterwards, I would have this intense desire for ginger beer. But that's another story. And then I read Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart. And I like to describe it as a glorious shock of discovery. Here were characters who had Igbo names and who ate yams and who inhabited a world that was kind of similar to mine. His novel taught me that my world was worthy of literature, that books could also be about people like me. It was about the same time that I read Kamara Lai's novel, The African Child, a beautiful, beautiful book that is elegiac and wonderfully defensive, and that too made me think of my world as worthy of literature. But I like to think of Chinua Achebe as the writer who gave me permission to write my stories. But although his characters were familiar in many ways, their world was also incredibly exotic in other ways, because they lived without the things that I saw as the norm in my life. They did not have cars or electricity or phones. They did not eat fried rice. In fact, I was horrified that they had fufu for breakfast because I consider fufu too heavy for breakfast. In other words, they lived the life that my great-grandfather might have lived. And this brings me to my second Things Fall Apart story. When I came to the U.S. to go to school, and I came because I was fleeing the study of medicine. When you do well in school in Nigeria, you're expected to become what we call a professional, which really means a doctor, an engineer if you're a boy, and maybe a lawyer. So I was expected to become a doctor, and I had been in what was called the science track in secondary school, which means that I had done the chemistries and the physics and the biologies, because that's what you did if you did well in school. And then I started the College of Medicine, and after a year, I realized that I would be a very unhappy doctor. And so, to prevent the future inadvertent deaths of patients, I fled, and America was my escape. But before I arrived in Philadelphia, my friend Ada, who was also Nigerian, but who had been in the U.S. for a number of years, found a four-bedroom apartment that I would share with some American students. And I remember how surprised my roommates were to see me. They said I was wearing American clothes, by which they meant the pair of jeans I had bought at the market in Osaka. And then I realized that maybe Things Fall Apart had played a role in this. They might have read it in high school, but maybe that teacher forgot to tell them that it was set in the Nigeria of 100 years ago. But back to number 305 Margaret Cartwright Avenue. The campus of the University of Nigeria was a small, safe, and happy place. Everybody knew everybody else. The children of the staff all attended the staff primary school and all went to the staff children's library. And so in that house, number 305 Margaret Cartwright Avenue, I began to write. I wrote at the dining table when I could not use the study desk because my father was walking or because his sibling was on the phone. The dining table was light green and long, and it was the family dumping ground of newspapers, university circulars, wedding invitations, magazines, bananas, groundnuts. And the tiny ants that lived underneath it appeared after breakfast to crowd around bits of sugar or bread. I always cleared a space for myself at one end, opposite the grand old wood-paneled air conditioner, which was used so rarely that a puff of dust always burst out first before cool air followed. I remember that we seemed to put it on only during birthday parties, and it was noisy. It made a loud whooshing sound. And so, during birthday parties when the living room was full of friends, there was always that loud sound of the air conditioner in the background. My brothers and I had separate bedrooms after our older siblings left home. Mine had a girlish table where I displayed my lotions, my creams, my powder compacts. It still did not have a desk. In 1997, I left home, and when I returned 4 years later with the final page proofs of my first novel, my parents had put a writing desk in my room. It was square and sturdy, and I spread out my page proofs and edited them there. A few years later, when I was writing my second novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, which is set during the Nigeria-Biafra War, I knew I needed to write a large part of it in Nigeria. I needed to go to my ancestral hometown. I needed to smell the dust there. And I also needed to be in number 305, Margaret Cartwright, that house that nurtured me, where I believed the literary spirits still hovered. When I returned, my parents had installed an air conditioner in my room. It was more modern, less noisy, and the lights blinked when I turned it on. I transcribed interviews at the dining table or at my father's desk in the study, but I wrote only in my room. And from time to time, I would look out at the veranda, which was no longer used much. Years of rain had stained the floor a dull gray. And I finished my novel there, sitting in my room and looking out at that veranda that had witnessed my childhood. I have often been asked why I chose to write about Biafra, and I like to say that I did not choose Biafra, that it chose me. I cannot honestly intellectualize my interest in the war. It is a subject I have known for very long that I would write about. I was born 7 years after the Nigeria-Biafra War ended, and yet the war is not mere history for me. It is also memory. I grew up in the shadow of Biafra. I knew vaguely about the war as a child, that my grandfathers had died, that my parents lost everything they owned. But long before my parents began to talk, particularly my father, under my keen questioning about their specific experiences, I was very much aware of how this war had haunted my family, how it colored the paths our lives had taken. My paternal grandfather died more than a year before the war ended, and because he was in Biafra 1, and my father was in a region called Biafra 2, and they were separated by an occupied road, my father could not go to the refugee camp where his father was buried. My father is the first son, and he takes his first son responsibilities very seriously. And in Igbo culture, one of the responsibilities of the first son is to ensure that his father gets a proper funeral. And so it broke my father's heart that his father died and he couldn't even go to see where he was buried. And so when the war ended in 1970, my father says that the first thing he wanted to do was to go and see where his father was buried. And he went to the refugee camp, which used to be a secondary school before the war, and asked where the grave was. And somebody pointed to just vague expanse and said, "We buried the people there." So it was a mass grave. And my father, who is the most undramatic of people, tells me that he bent down and took a handful of sand, and he has kept the sand ever since. My mother has still not spoken very much about losing her father, also in a refugee camp. But she spoke about the other things she had lost, her wig, her china that she had brought back from London. She spoke about going from making toast and scrambled eggs for her two little daughters to standing in line and fighting for dried egg yolk from the relief center. I am still known to cry stupidly about some of these stories, about the tiny losses that so many people endured, about this trail of physical and metaphysical losses. But I wanted to write a novel. I wanted to write about what I like to call the grittiness of being human. I wanted to write a book about relationships, about people who have sex and eat food and laugh. Because in addition to those terrible stories about the war, I also heard stories about weddings, about people falling in love. I was concerned with certain questions about what it means to be human. When you are deprived of the comforts of the life you know, when you go from eating sandwiches to eating rats, how does it change your relationship with yourself, with the people you love? After the novel was published, I was stunned by how many people embraced it as their own personal stories. At my readings, particularly in Nigeria, women would start to cry and to say, "Thank you for writing this, because finally I can tell my family what I went through." Men would get choked up talking about how they had been conscripted in the war as boys. And young people of my generation would get emotional talking about how they finally understood their parents, or how they finally understood our history as Nigerians. The novel started a conversation about a part of our history that remains contested and contentious. It humbled me and it made me very happy. But there's much that I cannot explain about my writing process. I find it difficult, for example, to answer what I think is the laziest question that anyone can ask a writer. Where do you get your inspiration? Just in case anybody was thinking about asking that question after the The question itself assumes that inspiration can somehow be explained and packaged into logical and digestible bits. But anything can be a source of inspiration. I'm a keen watcher of people, for example, and I carry with me a notebook to record whatever strikes me. The color of a woman's lipstick, an overhead conversation between strangers in a cafe, the slump of a man's shoulders in the departure lounge of an airport, all of which may become part of a piece of fiction. To write realistic fiction as I do is, I think, to try and make sense of the world by storytelling, by streamlining the chaotic nature of life into some sort of narrative with emotive points, and by hopefully doing that, we remind ourselves of what it means to be human. The process is a mix of the conscious and the unconscious. I'm not always in control of what I write. And for me, one of the magical things about writing fiction is that you start a story and you're in control, and then sometimes the story just overtakes you and characters do things that surprise you. But when I tell my brothers this, that sometimes the character did something, my brothers look at me as though I'm just a little crazy. And they say, "What do you mean you wrote the book? What do you mean the characters did something?" It's the sort of thing that's difficult for people who don't write to understand. My first novel, Purple Hibiscus, came organically, and the story more or less wrote itself. But it helped that I was miserable in the middle of a freezing Connecticut winter. And I was homesick for the warmth of Nsukka. I was thrilled that somebody actually wanted to publish the book, and I thought that maybe three people would buy it: my sister, my brother, and my best friend. And I was wonderfully surprised when more than three people bought it. But I also quickly realized that to be a Nigerian and an African, and to be published outside of home, was often to have my work looked at through a political lens. I would do readings outside of the continent of Africa, and often be asked or even be told that my novel was a political allegory, that my abusive father character represented Nigeria's brutal dictator, which was often news to me. I sometimes wondered why nobody asked me about love and about personal motivations and why I constantly had to be asked about the sociopolitical. Of course, I know the reason that so little is known about the part of the world from which I come that it is not very surprising that a novel would be seen as some kind of native explanation. But it does not change the truth, which is that when I sat down to write that father character in Purple Hibiscus, I was not thinking, I shall now write an important allegorical representation of Nigeria's military culture. I just wanted to write a human story about a man who was struggling with his demons. I think there are two ways to think about fiction, as a critic and as a creative person. And my general rule is to think as a critic only about the work of other people, never about my own work. Otherwise, I will, in fact, start writing a novel with the idea of writing an important allegorical representation of Nigeria's military culture. But knowing that so little is known about Nigeria, and by extension, Africa, makes me a little wary in writing truthfully about what interests me. My best friend Uju complains, and she's been complaining the past few months because I have been immersed in trying to finish a new novel, and she complains that she never sees me and I never return calls and we don't spend as much time as we would together. And this is true, because when my writing is going well, I become very inward. I lock myself up for weeks, and sometimes I don't shower. Not that you need to have that too much information bit, but... And it makes me think about the sacrifices that come with writing. The calls that are not returned, the time that you haven't spent with the people you love. Because for me, love means time spent. And this often leaves me with a clutch of small regrets in my soul. But it's a sacrifice I make willingly. It's a choice I make for my writing. And so my best friend, who was in her complaining, she said to me, well, just kill the character already so we can hang out. And really, I didn't know what, and I said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, you know, in your writing, somebody always has to die. And I wasn't quite sure how to take that. I was quite taken aback by it, actually. And then I thought about it for a while, and I realized, you know, she is right. Not that people don't always die in my work, but in a larger sense that as a writer and also as a reader, that I'm drawn to what is dark. I am drawn to melancholy. A kind of beautiful sadness is what I find most moving in writing and reading fiction. My brother has a son who's very bright, but who doesn't like to read. And so my brother said to me, why don't you consider writing for children? Maybe this will make Chinedum read. And so I thought about it for a while, and then I thought, you know, I really love children. I don't want to be responsible for their being traumatized. So I thought, no, I won't write children's books. I don't think that's a good idea. And so I write about love and the possibility of connection and all of that. But in the end, my vision is largely a dark one. My artistic vision is largely dark. And I sometimes wonder whether being African means that I must always indulge in these fragile negotiations in order to fully explore my artistic vision. When I write about war, for example, I find myself thinking, does this only perpetuate the stereotype of Africa as a place of war? So far, I have kept from making artistic choices based on this, but I do think about it, and it brings a certain discomfort. I will never forget how moved I was to read some years ago Nelson Mandela describing Chinua Achebe's novel Things Fall Apart. He called it the book in whose presence the prison walls came down. And I have a much smaller but similar personal story. Last year, I was reading a piece in the New York Times about an American woman called Lori Berenson, who had been convicted in Peru for aiding a leftist group, and she had been sentenced to 20 years in prison. She'd been granted parole, and her mother gave an interview talking about how her daughter had coped during her years in captivity. And reading, not surprisingly, was central to her coping. And then I read a line where her mother said that one of the books that was a favorite was a book called Half of a Yellow Sun. At first I read past, I thought, no, it can't be my book. It just seemed so improbable. And then the book was described as a book set in Nigeria, and I thought, wait, it is my book. Now, here was a woman I did not know of, who was not Nigerian, who was not in any way connected to Biafra, and yet this book had been meaningful to her at a very difficult time in her life. And reading that, I felt so moved, and I remember thinking, fiction does matter. When I first came to the US, fiction was very important to me. American fiction was very important to me. Even though I had consumed a lot of American media, as most of the world does, even though growing up in Osuka, I had watched Sesame Street and I was very familiar with Big Bird and Elmo, I felt a sense of dislocation when I arrived. Also, mostly because I thought that every black family would be like the Cosby Show. So you can imagine my surprise when I discovered that this was not so. And so I started to read American fiction. I read Toni Morrison and James Baldwin and Philip Roth and John Steinbeck and Willa Cather and John Updike and Mary Gaitskill. I read everything I could find. And in a way, America started to make sense to me. So now, to end the story about number 305 Margaret Cartwright Avenue. 4 years ago, my parents moved out of the house. They're now retired from the university, and the house has been assigned to another family. I was in the US when they moved out of the house, and so the week that they moved out, I talked to them on the phone, and I asked them ridiculous questions. "Did you find that doll that I lost in primary school?" I asked. "Did you keep my secondary school textbooks?" And throughout the conversation, I fought tears. My parents talked about the cartons they had bought and the lorries they had hired. They sounded practical and calm. How could they not see how momentous this was, I thought, that we're leaving behind 25 years of our lives? But of course they did. They simply are not much given to melodrama as I am. I hung up that day after talking to my parents, and I thought about the last time that I was in the house. There was a power failure at night, and in the pitch blackness, I walked from my room, down the stairs, into the dining room to find a candle in the cabinet. And I did not stumble once. Thank you so much for listening.
So I have some questions to start us off from some of the high schoolers you saw earlier today. And this one is from Grand High School, and it's about purple hibiscus, which is, I think they read. And the question is there one part of that story that you wish you could change?
No, I don't think so.
Good. No regrets. And following on that question, sort of related also about hibiscus, which character do you feel you relate to or with the most in that book?
It's like asking, you have 5 children, who do you love the most? And you just, actually, I think parents have favorites, but they pretend they don't. So I have a favorite character, but I'm going to pretend that I don't and just say that I feel connected to all of them equally. No, actually, the character of Amaka and the character of Auntie Forma, I feel a kind of mutuality with them.
So I want to lead on that a little bit because we first met when I was doing the Penn Festival in New York in 2004, and your book had just come out and you were a debut novelist, and Michael Ondaatje was like totally enamored with your work and in love with it. And so he wanted to do the interview with you for part of that festival. And so I went and called my friends at Penn and dug out the transcript of that. It went 2.5 hours and nobody moved. It was the most incredible conversation you've ever seen.
I was terrified.
So the question about hibiscus was, do you feel you could have written this, meaning Purple Hibiscus, in Nigeria? And your answer was, no, not this book. It would have been different. Why is that?
Because I wrote Purple Hibiscus, I was so homesick, and that it was a terrible, terrible winter in Connecticut. And I think that there's an incredible sense of nostalgia about that book, which could only have happened because I wasn't at home. And I think if I had been at home, the story might have been the same, but I think that it would have had a different air to it. It would have had sort of, you know, it wouldn't have been quite as sepia-toned as it is.
And so the most recent book, The Thing Around Your Neck, Book of Stories, takes place primarily, I would say, in America. And so was there differences? I mean, did you have to be in Nigeria to write that book or those stories? Was there a flip side? Because you split your time pretty evenly.
Right? I write better about America when I'm in Nigeria and better about Nigeria when I'm in America.
And why is that?
I don't know. I guess distance helps. So I collect materials. I'm constantly making notes about things. But it's very hard for me to turn it all into fiction when I'm there. So sometimes just having the distance, if I'm in Nigeria, I'm making notes about the present, but I'm actually writing about, you know, so often it's America and what I've observed there. In general, yes. Hmm.
And then Half a Yellow Sun seems to me sort of the in between those two books, and it is a novel, and it's sort of obviously directly historical, and you've already talked a little bit about this, but I wondered if we could get into the making of that book and how the making of that book was different. I mean, all these books were made in very different ways. Yeah. I think you said that the Book of Stories written, you know, has a span of most of your life as a Purple Hibiscus was written in a pretty compressed time period.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about writing Half a Yellow Sun, which does have a lot of history in it, some of it very personal, but some of it very kind of, you know, political?
Everything in Half of Yellow Sun happened to somebody. So all of the stories are based on real stories, so to speak. But I did a lot of research. I had piles of things I had discovered. I spent time in libraries. I looked at archives. And part of writing it, it was a very difficult book to write in many ways. And I think the first reason is that it was so personal in an emotional way. I was writing my family's history, my country's history. I was trying to make sense of something much bigger than I was, and so it was difficult to do. But also it was really difficult just to turn the facts into truths. I had all of this information, and the first few drafts were terrible because I was so eager to show off what I had found out in my research, and I thought, you know, I can't possibly have spent all that time in those moldy archives and not use all the things that I found. So I threw everything into the first few drafts. And part of the difficulty of writing the novel was then having to remind myself that in the end, the novel is about human beings. It's, you know, it's wonderful that I discovered sort of little bits of interesting information about what the American government did. But really, in the end, I wanted it to be about human beings. I wanted it to be character-driven. And so I had to make the choice about what to leave out. And that was difficult to do.
Now, you've lived here almost a decade. Are literary traditions falling, or American literary traditions, or language, sounds, structure, beginning to show up in your work that you can discern in a noticeable way yet?
I hope not.
How rude. What?
Do you sense that Andrew wants me to say something different?
I'm just a fan.
No, I think I'm influenced by everything I read and love, and you know, I clearly love a lot of American fiction, contemporary and not contemporary. I'm a very keen fan of Edith Wharton, for example, who I think is just as good as Henry James, but somehow, you know, he gets a lot more press, which is just annoying. But so I'm very much, but at the same time, I want to sound like me. I don't want to sound like anybody else. And so there isn't a conscious decision or effort to, you know, structure anything in an American way. Or no, there isn't. But I suppose in some way, in unconscious ways, everything I love has to influence. You know, I think that creativity is it's a cycle that you read things and they feed into your own writing. But you don't, hopefully, you don't exactly know how because you don't want to mimic. But I think that, you know, the books I love nurture my own writing. But as for language, I don't think so, and I really hope not, because I also want to sound like me, and I don't know, it would be odd to sound American.
And I
wouldn't even know how. But you know, I often say that America is like my rich uncle who gives me pocket money but doesn't always remember my name. So And I have a lot of affection for this uncle. But I you know, I can never really be. It's interesting. I mean, what Americanness means, and you know, what I love about this country is that just wonderful sense of possibility, and this thing that's called the American dream, which is kind of really not true, but we all believe it, and it's the believing that matters, I think. But then I often say, I've lived here for many years, and you know, back and forth, but I still look at America in wonder. I still often say America, and I shake my head, and you know, and I will never understand the game of baseball, so I just will never be an American. It's just.
Well, thank you so much for coming to Portland.
Thank you so much.
That was Chimamanda Adichie speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. Adichie is the author of Purple Hibiscus and Half a Yellow Sun. She spoke during the 2011-2012 season of Portland Arts and Lectures. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Emmon produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.